The Malibu Coast and the Pacific Coast Highway that traces it are American icons. Malibu's sparkling blue waters and striking cliffs have attracted Hollywood stars and carefree surfers alike with the promise of sun-drenched days and endless summers. But few people know the story of how Malibu came to be established as a California paradise. In the new book, The King and Queen of Malibu, The True Story of the Battle for Paradise, reporter and best-selling author David Randall uncovers a tale of money and power, deceit and desperation, and ultimately of the modernization of the Golden State itself. The name of the book, The King and Queen of Malibu, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Randall to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. Very nice to have you with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
What brought you to this particular subject of wanting to look at Malibu and its ultimate creation?
So I grew up in Southern California, and I was a surfer. I drove up and down PCH, and I never knew or never actually thought about the backstory of this road until I moved out to the East Coast. I was in my first blizzard, and I thought, you know, this is terrible. I was homesick. I wanted to read anything I could about California. And I started reading these old issues of the LA Times, and I started seeing mentions of this woman who owned all of Malibu, and she had guards on horseback with shotguns, and homesteaders were trying to invade her property and trying to kill her. And I just thought, what is this? It sounded like an alternative history. And so I started exploring it, and I discovered that the Ringes, which were Frederick and May Ringe, who owned all of Malibu, they were kind of some of the forgotten forefathers of modern Los Angeles and played a huge part in the city's development, but it had all been forgotten.
So you start the story with Frederick Hastings Ringe. Tell us a little bit about this man. He was originally from Boston, how he ended up in California, and ultimately how they ended up with this property.
So he grows up in Cambridge, and his father, Samuel Ringe, he comes up from nothing. He becomes a prominent person in Cambridge. Frederick himself, though, he's the only one of the six Ringe children to survive to adulthood. And he himself is always very ill. He always seems like trapped in his own body and then trapped in this big mansion with the absence of all his siblings all around him. He survives. Yeah, he goes to Harvard. He becomes friends with Teddy Roosevelt. But his illness, he can never quite outrun it. So like many people at the time, he goes west for his health. And it's fascinating in so many ways to think, you know, here's this young boy who was trapped in his body, and he always dreamed of being a cowboy. And he did it. He went out west. He went in Colorado. He went to New Mexico, and I could read his diaries of everywhere he went. He ends up in Los Angeles. He meets and marries May Ringe, who kind of comes from the opposite. She's the seventh of 13 kids on a Michigan farm, and Frederick is always trying to survive and to beat his illness. May, her life was always trying to survive just to have enough money. So they get to Los Angeles in 1887 during the first big real estate boom. And in Los Angeles at this time is only one step removed from the frontier. Los Angeles in 1850 was probably the most violent place in U.S. history. But the railroads changed all that. It creates a gigantic boom. And Frederick thinks, you know, I want to make my name in a new city. You know, Cambridge already seems like it's a place already won. He inherits $140 million in today's money from his father when his father dies. And Frederick, in the midst of all this boom where everybody else is making millions, it seems like so quickly, it weighs heavily on him. So he decides to donate all of his money to Cambridge. So that's why if you're in Cambridge today, he donated money for the city hall, for the public library. He created what is now known as the Ringe and Latin High School, which is the main high school in the city. And his big thought is, you know, people are going to go out to Los Angeles for the weather. I want to give them a reason to stay. So he starts things like life insurance companies, you know, waterworks. He builds a streetcar line in Santa Barbara. He builds boardwalk amusements in Long Beach to help it essentially transition from frontier to modern city. And this boom is all around him. He decides, you know, I want to have a place where I can kind of keep Southern California as it was for myself. So he discovers what's now Malibu. It was a Spanish land grant, 13,000 acres. He buys all of it for about $10 an acre, which is, you know, maybe $5,000 an acre in today's money. Still pretty good deal, obviously. And he sees this as his paradise and his own private paradise where he can be in Los Angeles and he can make a big city and he can, you know, be part of and have his own business empire. But Malibu is his own place. And, you know, growing up, with so much death all around him, he became a very religious man. You know, he kind of saw the Bible as, you know, a way for eternal life. So he sees Malibu too as almost this cathedral. So he imagines how much pleasure God himself must have had and when he made it all, and, you know, in Frederick's view. So he owns all of this. It's his own private paradise. But what happens is that they're not the only ones there. The Homestead Act brought so many people out west to California, and the homesteaders live in the Santa Monica Mountains right behind what is now Malibu. And they need to get across Malibu to get to the ocean, to the beach, so they can make the trek down to Santa Monica. That's where they can get food. That's where they can get supplies. You know, that's where they can get medicine for their kids. Because the other way is very treacherous. The coast, even at that time, was very treacherous. So that starts off this conflict between the homesteaders and the Ringe family. And when Frederick Ringe dies suddenly at the age of 48, it takes it to another level. May Ringe, his wife, inherits a fortune now that would be worth now about $700 million in today's money, and that's not even counting the land holdings. And she suddenly becomes the head of this business empire that stretches from Los Angeles to San Francisco to Boston to gold mines in Colombia, all at a time when she doesn't even have the right to vote. So at Frederick's funeral, all of, you know, the most elite people in Los Angeles, you know, one of California's sitting U.S. senators was one of Frederick's pallbearers, which kind of shows you to the degree of how powerful he was. People openly talk about, you know, who is May going to marry? Who is she going to have to take over all of this? Because they just can't even conceive of a woman this powerful. And she defies them all. And she spends the next 30 years essentially trying to keep Malibu as her own private kingdom. And she's willing to go to all stops.
You write in the book that the Ringes moved to Malibu in 1892. And even though this was paradise and what they were battling for, life on that ranch was often very difficult.
It was. It was definitely the idea that you have to provide for yourself. So it was hard to even get to it. You had to get to Malibu from Santa Monica on horseback at the time. The Ringes literally kept a tide chart in their drawer and almost functioned as if a train schedule. You know, they had to leave at the right time or else they would get stuck on the beach and marooned by high tide. And there were times when, you know, Frederick and May Ringe had to lead their horses by hand because they got the tide schedule. It was hard. The settlers there, too, they had to essentially shoot whatever they could to survive. There's very little flat land in Malibu. It's funny that it's always thought of as this, you know, paradise, and it is beautiful, but it's not a place where humans are necessarily supposed to live. There were 17 steep canyons. There were grizzly bears. There were rattlesnakes everywhere. There's constant fires and floods. So to subdue paradise was a battle in itself.
When, as May becomes one of the wealthiest women in the country, this has a psychological effect on her. This has quite an effect on her in this fight to keep this property.
Exactly. So she grew up very, very poor. And, you know, with her mindset is, I'm now one of the most, you know, wealthiest people in the country. I've played a part in this empire, building this empire just as much as Frederick. Why should I have to give it all up just because I'm a woman? You know, Frederick at his time was so powerful that the railroads never tried to build through Malibu out of deference to him. But as soon as he dies, that's when the railroads start saying, we need to move through here. That's when the federal government starts saying, we need to build a road through here. That's when the homesteaders start saying, you know, I have this incentive to kill this person, because if this person is no longer living, my life becomes a lot easier because I can get to the beach and I can get to Los Angeles very easily. So May also sees Malibu as the place where she spent the best times of her life with her husband as well and with their three kids. So she doesn't want to give that up. She decides to build her own railroad and kind of outwits some of the most powerful people in the state. And it's because of May that there's no railroad tracks through Malibu. If you look at the rest of California coast, there's railroad tracks up and down it. But she, over time, you know, she places keeping Malibu and keeping it untouched above all. Her eldest son eventually sues her, saying that if Frederick had lived, he would have developed it into an American Riviera. You know, there'd be hotels and there'd be marinas and everything else. And she, to placate him, gives him some money or some land that's in the family estate, and he develops it, and that's what's known as Miracle Mile in Los Angeles today.
I guess there's two ways of looking at this, and you talk about this in the book, that either, you know, you can look at it that here's a woman who is so selfish and she wants to keep it all to herself, or that she is responsible and working so hard to save this coastline from development.
Exactly. And that's one of the tensions in the story that captivated me. So at the time, you know, for 30 years, 35 years after Frederick's death to May's death, she's the most hated woman in Los Angeles. The Los Angeles Times is very pro-development at the time, so every story about her, she just sounds like a pariah. And Los Angeles, the elite of the city, they start pushing her away too. You know, they no longer want to be associated with her. And she never felt comfortable in that society in the first place. Frederick grew up with money. She didn't. And it's ironic in some ways, too, and kind of sad that her kids grew up with money. So they don't quite understand her, too. So she keeps on getting pushed to the margins. And, you know, from the homesteader perspective and from, you know, anybody who wants to go into Malibu itself now, of course, you know, she was trying to keep this beautiful place all to herself. You know, it's 27 miles of coastline. It almost seems insane that it's one person's private property. But then you take a step back, too, and, you know, she did have the law on her side. The reason she lost the case, lost Malibu eventually, and why PCH was there, it had to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was a landmark eminent domain decision. And the fact that, you know, usually eminent domain taking private property for public use, it has to be something of obvious public necessity, like a military base or something. What the County of Los Angeles argued was that this place was so beautiful that it was a public necessity for the average person to be able to come and see it because it would make them a better person. It was this, you know, progressive era idea, the same idea behind, you know, beautification efforts of Central Park or Washington, D.C., that that bringing somebody into a beautiful place is a very easy and quick way into making them a better person. So the irony of it was that, you know, the beauty of Malibu is what brought the Ringes there, and it's also the beauty of Malibu that made Ringe ultimately lose it.
As you write, she ultimately was responsible for bringing Hollywood celebrities into this paradise. How so?
So she, after they build PCH, she spent, you know, 30 years trying to keep everybody out, so her vast fortune is dwindling very quickly. But she still remains incredibly defiant. Los Angeles County, after they built PCH, they cut her a check for $2 million for the value of the land that they took, and she refuses to cash it. She doesn't want any part, doesn't want to show that she's giving up whatsoever. But she does open up a very small part of the beach for what becomes known as the Malibu Movie Colony. And she only sees it as a stopgap. So even the leases, they say, you know, after 7 or 8 years, whatever structures on this property is going to be demolished. So the people who, you know, build, it's mostly Hollywood at the time, who build cottages there, they have no incentive to build, you know, a legitimate building. They just literally hire their set designers to come out. So they really were a little more than movie sets. You could literally punch your hand through the wall to the house next door. But that money helps her, and she decides to start building a 50-room mansion for herself as almost the symbol that, you know, even though PCH is there, nobody can step off of that public land into her property, and the Ringes are always going to own Malibu. She sadly decides to float bonds to pay for this in April of 1929, and by October is the Great Crash and sort of the Great Depression. So if it wasn't for that, she really would have gone through her entire life with never selling a single acre of Malibu.
The name of the book is The King and Queen of Malibu, The True Story of the Battle for Paradise. The book is published by Norton. David Randall, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The King and Queen of Malibu. It's published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.